I'm Emma Sangali. We're here in opposition to the APIA conference in Perth, which is a gathering of some of the largest executives and lobbyists for the fossil fuels industry in Australia. There's a large political presence as well, because our politicians are in very close with this industry, and we're here to raise the alarm about that tie and how dangerous it is for us. So we have Kelly Hawes and Carmen Leber on top of a truck that is parked in the driveway to the Perth Convention and Exhibition Centre. It's the last day of the APIA conference, and they're going to stay there until police can get them down safely.
And from essentially ensuring that we have a livable future for your children, for our children, and for generations to come, we are willing to risk arrest, we are willing to stand up here today, because we need to make this sacrifice. It is necessary in order to protect us for the future.
Today, our main demand is that there are no new fossil fuel projects approved by the WA government. So there has recently been a report by the International Energy Agency saying that if any new fossil fuel projects are approved globally, we will not achieve net zero emissions by 2050, which is itself far, far too late. Our demand is 2025. The approval of any new projects, including the Scarborough project led by Woodside, is completely unacceptable, and it hasn't been done with any public consultation. So that's all we ask, is that there is public consultation in these decisions.
Have you any opportunity to connect with the delegates from this APIA Conference 21?
No, surprisingly, they don't really want to chat with us. We would be happy to connect with these delegates. Oh, sorry, I have to take this.
Yep, you go for it.
Hi. Welcome to Understory. This 23rd of June 2021. I'm Elizabeth Poe. You've just heard from Extinction Rebellion protesters outside last week's Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, or APIA for short, national conference held at the Perth Convention Centre. The gathering of the hydrocarbon clan each year is an opportunity to share industry insights, hear from the government and the opposition, and celebrate the contribution of fossil fuels to our global economy. But the economic winds have changed. Partly it's been COVID-19 driving down demand for fossil fuels, but it's also that the global trend now is away from fossil fuels into renewables. But the big one is climate. If humanity is to meet our climate targets, there can be no new fossil fuel projects anywhere in the world. Even the guardians of oil and gas are beginning to draw a line. Sally Bogle from the industry magazine Energy News Bulletin has called International Energy Agency recent net zero emission report a bombshell. This net zero emissions announcement has been, according to the Energy News Bulletin, quote, a bolt from the blue and a complete reversal of the agency's previous agenda, which has been to buffer the secure supply of fossil fuels, unquote. This changing international framework means Australia is at risk of being left behind. In practical terms, our reluctance to join global trends means our energy exports will soon attract border taxes because of our failure to act on net zero emissions. Labor's Shadow Resources Minister is Madeleine King, member for Brand, and she had a speaker's spot at APIA this year. The Shadow Minister was keen to highlight the failure of the Australian government to act on climate change and raised this question of border taxes.
It's blatantly obvious that the Morrison government is completely isolated on the world stage when it comes to taking action on climate change. More than 120 countries, including 70% of our trading partners, as well as every state and territory in the country, have committed to a target of net zero emissions by 2050. But not this government. We've seen the Business Council of Australia, the National Farmers Federation, the Australian Industry Group, and many others, our biggest airline, our biggest banks, our biggest employers, and countless other companies commit to the target. But not this government. Our exporters, including many of you in the room, understand that action is urgently needed and the cost of inaction will be steep. Many now face the prospect of carbon border taxes, which are being actively considered by the European Union, the UK, and the US. These taxes will be designed to hit nations, including Australia, that have made insufficient efforts to combat global climate change. The world is moving on and we are being left behind.
However, in her APIA address, Labor's Shadow Minister for Resources, Madeleine King, skipped over State Labor's climate action performance. Her Labor state colleague, Minister for Commerce, Amber Jade Sanderson, a couple of weeks ago put on her Environment Minister hat to sign through the Scarborough gas project at Burrup. This State Labor decision ignores international advice and gives Woodside the go-ahead for Australia's largest fossil fuel project. So, both Labor and Liberal are drawing criticism for their current approach to the hydrocarbon industry. Here's highlights of Green Senator Jordan Steele-John speaking in the Australian Senate 2 weeks ago.
We are in a climate emergency. And yet, across our nation, particularly in our north, the major parties are opening up massive gas projects. From the Beedaloo in the NT to the Scarborough gas project in Western Australia, both parties are in lockstep towards the precipice of oblivion. This is one of the most disgraceful moments in Australian political history. When the world is moving to action on the climate crisis, Australia has dug itself in. The Morrison government, helped by Anthony Albanese's so-called opposition, is leading the charge of the denialists globally, blocking action on climate change left, right and centre, particularly here in the Asia-Pacific region, when our neighbours and friends are struggling with the reality of the water lapping round their ankles. We turn up to international fora after international fora and block action. Why do we do it? Why is it that these two parties are so willing to sell the future of young people, particularly in this country? Because they take millions for it. Because they are on the take. $2 million from Woodside alone, given between 2013 and 2020 to the major parties. And just a few weeks ago, we see the former Treasurer of Western Australia leave his position and join the board of Rio Tinto and join the board of Woodside and claim $400,000 for it. The disgusting, slimy turnstile of Australian politics on full display.
To which those from Extinction Rebellion also raise concern about the revolving door of senior Labor advisers coming from or going into the oil and gas industry. Here's Emma.
Of the past five WA premiers, four have had senior advisers that have either prior to their appointment or after their appointment been senior executives in those industries as well.
Although the Extinction Rebellion protests outside the Perth Convention Centre might have unnerved one or two of the delegates, it is shareholder activism that most preoccupies the coal, oil and gas industries. It's the logic of the market turned against the proponents of the market. When shareholders demand better economic value, boards have to radically rethink their ways of doing things. John McGlue from Castle Gates facilitated the plenary on shareholder activism. For those not in the know, Castle Gates is a consultancy which helps its clients manage disputes and shareholder activism, as well as special situations. Castle Gates has a strict bottom line focus, they say. Amid complexity and chaos lies opportunity. So perhaps John McGlue was the right person to introduce, Robert Blood from SigWatch. Understory's Adrian Glamorgan got his media pass and headed inside the APIA conference to find out more.
And I'm delighted to welcome, I hope, from London, coming in from the UK very shortly, Robert Blood. And he is, he's got a really interesting background. He runs an organisation called SigWatch. He was the founder of it, he's the chief executive of it. And this is an organisation that gets under the skin of activism. His clients include multinationals, oil and gas companies, people in the resources sector, right across the industrial spectrum, he's got them. And he produces research, he gets an understanding of where activism is emerging and trending and going, and he gives deep insights to commercial corporate organisations about how to engage. And at a level, some of the stuff I've read that he has authored before is around this notion, what industry can learn from activism and from activists. So please make Robert very welcome. Thank you.
The kickoff session is about shareholder activism, and this is of particular interest to us because we've been monitoring for many years the way that activist groups, what we call NGOs, are trying to influence the financial markets to take positions on carbon businesses and fossil fuel businesses, which are clearly not necessarily in your interests. So what we do is we track NGO campaigns all around the world across nearly 10,000 different NGOs, looking for themes, looking for issues that are rising or falling, how priorities are changing within the global NGO movement, not just environment, but also development NGOs, human rights NGOs, even animal rights NGOs, every category of external non-political pressure. And the big changes that you can see on this 10-year chart is how not only has climate activism increased enormously, but how particularly it's increased in Europe. And we think that's really important because inevitably, you know, a country like Australia is really facing in two directions. It's very much politically, ideologically influenced by Europe and also by North America. But at the same time, its market influence is very much around Asia. So this sense of being pulled in two directions at once clearly is a real dilemma for Australian industry and particularly for your energy industry. And reconciling those two often conflicting pressures is a challenge not only for yourselves but also for NGOs trying to influence what your industry is doing. So the fact that Europe has really bought into climate change activism in a major way is the standout finding. A significant increase as well, but not so much in North America. You can see how it died back a bit, and that coincides with the Trump administration. Environmental NGOs on the climate issue sort of almost gave up for the last couple of years of his administration. And then as soon as Biden was elected, you notice it then shot up again as they realized they would have a friendly ear in the White House and in the administration. But you can also see a steady rise in campaigning activity in the Asia Pacific zone. And this is not only in Australia, we're also seeing this in countries like Japan, in South Korea, in Indonesia, Malaysia, so all around the region, but obviously not nearly as intense as it is in other parts of the world. And meanwhile, Latin America really has hardly shifted at all. So as a region that is still yet to take on board the full impact of climate change and to listen to its activists, this is still very much a region in development. But the real force of global activism is coming from Europe and then from North America. So Australia itself, what comes out here is that, again, a very steep rise in activism, but about a year later than the rest of the world, or certainly than Europe, but still very much there, still becoming particularly strong in the last 4 years. It's the separation of your customers from the producers, that is perhaps one of the most interesting trends that we are seeing. We're seeing this not only in Australia, but in other markets, that the energy producing companies are increasingly being left rather isolated, not only by some of their investors, but also some of their potential major customers. And, you know, ultimately, every company that commits to 100% renewable energy is a company that's no longer buying oil and gas. And that has to be a significant factor when more and more companies of greater and greater size start to make those kinds of policy decisions. The next factor is the way that NGOs have been targeting the finance sector. This has been of particular interest to us over the years. Not only, again, a really massive increase. In fact, it's been steadily increasing for 10 years, but it really took off again from 2018 onwards. But what you notice from this chart is how the issue was very much dominated by coal. At least coal and oil and gas were running at about the same rate in terms of levels of campaigning. But in the last 4 to 5 years, oil and gas has increasingly become the leading theme for this kind of campaigning. And what we sense from interpreting and analysing NGO campaigning in this area is that they now feel that coal is essentially a one battle. They're still pressing on coal in areas like developing countries in Asia, to some extent in Latin America, but they feel that that campaign has been won, but it's now about sort of finishing off the details. It's the military would say, sort of defeating in detail. They've won the big campaigns. And so now they're very much turning to oil and gas. And if you're not already feeling that pressure, you're certainly going to feel a lot more in the next 2 to 3 years, in our estimation, as that resource from coal switches to oil and gas in a big way. One of the most interesting trends of the last few years has been the targeting of the insurance sector on fossil fuels. Now, the insurance sector has always been a target because of their huge investment funds. As big asset managers, of course, they have a major target for divestment campaigns. But what's been occurring in the last few years now, and particularly in the last year, is targeting of insurers in terms of their underwriting business. So trying to separate insurers from fossil fuel projects, particularly oil and gas pipelines, and major infrastructure projects like LNG terminals. Again, this is something which is of moderate success for the NGOs, although it's still early days yet, but they're beginning to get some interesting separations. They've managed to separate a lot of insurers from the Adani project, the coal mine project, of course, in Queensland, but also in Canada, they're beginning to break insurers away from the Enbridge oil sands pipeline. So this is a very strategic way of damaging the financial and business prospects of infrastructure projects. But clearly, as they're able to make a stronger and stronger case for demonizing at least certain kinds of fossil fuels, this is becoming more and more successful for NGOs. And of course, as always, when they find a successful strategy, they tend to put even more resources into it than before. So what's working now will work on an even bigger scale in the months ahead. So something to be aware of. You certainly can't rely on your insurers anymore to automatically renew or issue new policies. The result of all this, and when we created this list, our researchers were going through recent campaigning just to list what's been going on. The kill rate from NGO campaigning in the last 5 years has really been quite remarkable. In fairness, actually more like the last 10 years, but Arctic offshore drilling is gone. Effectively, that will almost certainly never restart. Shale gas production, which was going to be a major player in New York State, was killed dead thanks to shale gas campaigning. Of course, Europe is now a no-go zone for shale gas, although it was the great hope of gas expansion only 5 years ago. And as I'm sure you know, the Keystone XL oil sands transporter pipeline, that's the US-Canada pipeline, has now been officially cancelled. It's actually been cancelled by TransCanada themselves, so they've now recognised the fact that without getting a political approval, it can no longer go ahead, even though they'd built almost the entire pipeline. The only bit they hadn't built was the bit across the border. So a very expensive cancellation, and at the same time, really a pointer to the way that infrastructure projects are becoming very difficult to push through, at least in the US, which is also happening abroad. So in Canada, oil sands development is now very constrained. That's also for economic reasons, but NGO pressure really has stopped any new projects developing. It's becoming very hard to develop new energy export terminals, much as the industry would love to push those through. There have been several, particularly gas pipeline cancellations in the last couple of years, due almost mainly to NGO pressure, in some cases economics, but mainly NGO pressure. Huge pressure not to expand any further the gas network in Europe. Obviously, that's very controversial. Gas is still seen, as it is in Australia, as a transition fuel. The gas industry is putting great lobbying resources into being allowed to expand its network, but they're also facing huge hostility from the NGO movement and from the Green and left parties to constrain that, or at least not allow the network to get any larger than it is. And now we're seeing major gas-producing countries like the Netherlands and the UK actually quite deliberate attempts to reverse the use of gas and scale back the use of gas in favour of renewably generated electricity. So this does seem to be a one-way ratchet. And it's also worth noticing that when we consult with investment managers and advisors to investors, that many of these activities, even if they're not actually stopped, are now identified as what you might call notifiable ESG material risks. That means that investors are now basically putting tick boxes against these kinds of fossil fuel developments as red flags for maybe denying investment or limiting investment to companies that are involved in those kinds of activities. Certainly we're seeing that with European investors. We haven't seen it yet significantly in American investors, but that is beginning to take off. As you know, BlackRock, JP Morgan, all the major investors have announced much tighter ESG criteria for their investment funds, and that will obviously affect fossil fuels particularly. So the upshot of all this is the way that the big institutional investors are now repositioning against fossil fuels. It has to be seen as a sign of things to come in the way that NGOs have managed to cooperate or sort of gather in the financial community as willing cooperators in their climate campaigns, using that lever as the major one against your industry. It's really a question of how the industry should manage, I suppose, what you might call a kind of fighting retreat, which is to how to maintain an industry. The fact that NGOs themselves feel that they're winning this particular battle in a big way. They've still got lots of skirmishes to fight, but they feel that the climate argument is now essentially won in a emotional sense. Now it's a matter of the details of how to wrap up different industries, how to scale back projects, how to stop new projects being developed. And that's where they're focusing their attention. The way we're looking at this now and the way we are advising our own clients is actually to focus rather less on the NGOs now, but actually rather more on the stakeholders that have been directly influenced by those NGOs.
Who has done this really well in those more mature markets where activism has taken hold a lot earlier and in a bigger way in North America and in Europe? Yeah. Which companies have done this exceptionally well?
I don't think it's any company that's done it exceptionally well, but I think what is striking is the difference in reaction from energy producers and energy users. And obviously it's a lot easier for energy users to make the bigger commitments, but what you're seeing from the fossil fuel industry, I mean, certainly in Europe, almost entirely not in North America yet, are quite strong, but still somewhat hedged commitments towards net zero. So we've seen, for example, what's happened to Shell. It felt that it had a industry-leading, class-leading commitment on or phase-out plan for net zero, which was within literally weeks struck down by the Dutch courts as being inadequate for meeting the Netherlands' own climate commitments. So I think that's the kind of pressure, certainly in Europe, that companies are facing, is that if they can be taken to court and lose over business policy positions like how fast to decarbonize, then clearly the whole industry has to go in a much more aggressive way to deal with that. So they're certainly not doing it because they want to, but they're doing it because they're being dragged into it. Whether that will set a benchmark for the Australian industry, I think remains to be seen. And the difference is, of course, that you're not operating in the Netherlands. You're operating in a much friendlier political environment, so you've got far more room for manoeuvre than the North European IOCs have.
I'm Elizabeth Poe. Thanks to Adrian Glamorgan for this report. Extinction Rebellion speakers, and APIA for welcoming Understory to last week's national conference. Be sure to recommend this episode to your friends. So remember, you can go online for RTRFM or subscribe to the Understory podcast in all the usual places. We hope to have you join us next week, when again, there'll be more to explore with Understory, radio for the planet.